There were several hundred members of the cartels, but only 50 were powerful. And of these, the handful which influenced world events and formed the Harvey United Steel Company cartel, the Nobel Dynamite Trust, the various rifle, gunpowder, and similar cartels were Krupp in Germany, Vickers Armstrong in Britain, Schneider Creusot in France, Škoda in Austria-Hungary, Cerny Ansaldo in Italy, Mitsui in Japan, and the Bethlehem Steel Company and DuPont Empire in the United States. Charles M. Schwab's Bethlehem held 4,301 shares in the Harvey cartel. Albert Vickers was chairman. It should be noted here that just as American big business was found at the time of the First World War to be linked to Japanese big business through the Harvey cartel, Nobel International Trust and other It should be noted here that just as American big business was found at the time of the First World War to be linked to Japanese big business through the Harvey cartel, Nobel International Trust and other agencies, so just before the outbreak of the global war, World War II, it was discovered that the international of money was even stronger than ever. One of the links was the IG Farben industry, which Hitler and Goering controlled and which involved Standard Oil, Standard Drug, General Motors, and General Electric and other of our greater corporations. Interrupting, of course, again, the international cartel connections of American big business with that of Nazi Germany were the main focus of Uncle Sam and the Swastika, an archive show available from Archives on Audio, and also were gone into in considerable measure in Radio Free America shows 2, 1, and 2, and also were touched on in a big way in Radio Free America number 10. Resuming Seldes' account, and here he goes into the international cartel connections linking American big business with the Japanese Zaibatsu. Just as American big business was linked to Japan through the Harvey Combine, steel, the Nobel Dynamite Trust, munitions, and the other munitions cartels before the last war, so before the global war, or World War II, there were the usual international cartels in which both the U.S. and Japan shared with Germany, Italy, and other nations. In addition, according to the San Francisco journalist John Pittman, quote, among the owners of Japanese business are International General Electric, which operates plants through its subsidiary, Tokyo Shibaura, Westinghouse Electric International, associated with Mitsubishi Electric Manufacturing Company, Tidewater Associated Oil, handled by Mitsubishi, Libby Owens Ford, represented by the Nippon Plate Glass Company, Standard Oil, with a known direct investment of $5 million, exclusive of frozen credits and oil in storage, Ford and General Motors, with approximately $10 million sunk in Japan proper, Eastman Kodak, and Singer Sewing Machine, with big organizations in the Japanese Empire, United Engineering and Foundry Company, holding a large stake in Shibaura United Engineering Company. Besides these shares in the industry of Japan proper, American capital is heavily invested in Manchukuo and other exploitation companies of a Japanese origin scattered throughout the Far East. Bear in mind, too, that we're talking about 1943 when the dollar was worth many times what it's worth today. The point being here, obviously, that we have a similar situation in many respects to the kinds of international capital and cartel relations which pertain between the United States and Nazi Germany. The same capital relations applied to the relationships between American big business and the Zaibatsu in Japan. It should be noted, too, that to this day there are significant international capital relations between the U.S. and Japan. One of the things that I've always found pretty ironic about the bellyaching concerning the Japanese inroads into the American automobile market is that the major American auto manufacturers have key investments in the Japanese auto industry. Ford owns a controlling interest in Mazda, for example, and many other American auto manufacturers have major investments in the very companies that are putting American auto workers out of business, and that's something that should be borne in mind. That, again, it's a brief account, but that'll give us some idea of just what Japanese fascism was all about. And again, if people think that fascism is something that used to exist, that has no application to today, just go down and open an account at the Sumitomo Bank. The Zaibatsu aren't only in Japan anymore, and Sumitomo, among others, are very much with us today. And again, there are branches of the Sumitomo Bank all over. I'm not criticizing somebody who works for that bank or its management or anything else. The level of control here is such that if you want to look for the culprits for this kind of evil, you have to go right to the top. So again, I don't want somebody that perhaps is associated with one of these institutions as an employee to get bent out of shape at my citing them basically as fascist institutions. The cold fact of the matter is that's what they are. We're going to review now a couple of excellent articles sent in by a listener, which should chill the blood and depress the mind of any loyal, patriotic American. These concern basically the precarious international situation in which the United States now finds itself in as a result of the monstrous spending by the Reagan administration, which has literally turned the United States from the greatest creditor nation in the world, which it was in 1980 and had been since the end of World War I, to the world's biggest debtor nation, which we are today. Reagan's economic miracle accomplished this in 8 short years, and of course the major portion of the bankrupting has been to finance a massive military buildup. I guess you could say that we have all sold our birthright to the merchants of death. An excellent op-ed column appeared in the New York Times of Thursday, July 21st of 1988, which reflects this depressing capital situation to the current American presidential race and makes clear in no uncertain terms that the Japanese and Germans, in addition to holding our purse strings, are in a sense holding our G-strings as well. Basically, the future, politically and economically, of the United States now belongs to Japan and Germany, and, well, they're not saying here to a certain extent to the Arabs, too. They also have invested heavily in American T-bills. Again, the New York Times of Thursday, July 21st, 1988. This is by Jeffrey E. Garten, G-A-R-T-E-N. Its headline, How Bonn and Tokyo Slyly Help Bush. While Americans will choose their next president in November, the Japanese and West German governments have already cast their votes. George Bush is their man, and they are propping up the dollar to assure him smooth economic sailing in the campaign. Our allies have always had a big stake in presidential elections, and with the exception of Jimmy Carter, they have favored incumbents. But it is always hard for foreign governments to express a preference without appearing to intervene. This year, they have found a way. Here is how Bonn and Tokyo are using their hammerlock and our currency to cast their votes. Jeffrey E. Garten is president of the Elliott Group Incorporated, an investment banking company. Resuming with the article, here is how Bonn and Tokyo are using their hammerlock and our currency to cast their votes. As everyone knows, our gigantic budget and trade deficits are being paid for by sales of bonds to overseas investors. But the trade deficit puts a downward pressure on the dollar that tends to drive away foreign investors. Thus, to keep the foreign funds flowing, the Fed normally has to raise the interest rates. But higher rates choke off American growth, which would be bad for the party in the White House. The administration would prefer that foreigners support the dollar without the incentive of higher interest rates. And, lo and behold, that is exactly what is happening. The dollar has risen steadily against the Japanese yen and the German mark in these past few weeks, faltering only slightly in recent days. As a result, the pressure for a rise in interest rates has been lessened. We can tell that Bonn and Tokyo are campaigning for Mr. Bush because their recent decisions make no sense economically, but quite a lot of sense politically. Between September of 1985 and last month, the major industrialized nations pushed the dollar down from the dizzying heights reached during the first Reagan administration. The reason, of course, was that the sky-high greenback was crippling American exports and sucking in imports, all of which created large trade deficits and protectionist pressures. Through these efforts, the dollar fell by some 50% against the mark and the yen, and American exports began to pick up. Still, despite some modest improvements in the trade balance these past few months, the consensus among economists never wavered that the dollar would have to decline by much more to rectify our lopsided deficits. Then, just 6 weeks ago, at the Economic Summit meeting in Toronto, the government suddenly decided that the dollar had dropped far enough. Not much had changed in economic terms, but the primary election season was over, and with the election fast approaching, the trade deficit remained dangerously large and foreign debt continued to grow. The decision at Toronto was a political signal, a wink to the markets that the greenback would not be allowed to fall at least through November. This, in turn, encouraged speculators to buy up dollars, which further strengthened the currency. Bonn and Tokyo are backing Vice President Bush not only because they generally support President Reagan's foreign policy, but because they are worried about noises from the Dukakis campaign about the Allies providing more for their own military defense, about tougher trade policies, and about a slowing of the pace of foreign takeovers. What's the harm of a little election year politicking? Plenty. Or what's the harm of a little election year politicking? Plenty. These currency shenanigans will exact a high cost after the election. Since our trade accounts cannot be balanced without further dollar depreciation, the higher the currency goes now, the further it will fall later. The next administration then could be saddled with a steep fall of the dollar, pressure to hike interest rates, another collapse on Wall Street, and a recession. Politicians are used to accusing the Federal Reserve of rigging elections by manipulating monetary policy. But the role of foreign central banks adds a new dimension. We should not be surprised at this. Since our debts abroad begin to exceed our earnings, which happened during the last 2 years, other governments were thrust into powerful creditors' positions. Washington has never been shy about using its economic clout to influence elections abroad. Now, America can see how it feels to be on the receiving end. And against that sobering article, reflect on the following information. Again, research credit to the same listener. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, August 22nd of 1988. This is from a column called Point of View by Penelope Hartland Thunberg, or Thunberg, T-H-U-N-B-E-R-G. She, by the way, is the William M. Scholl Fellow in International Business at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. And a small section of this article reads about the central bankers, the role of foreign central banks. Increasingly, they have urged the U.S. Treasury to issue securities in foreign currencies. In promising to repay a fixed amount of yen, marks, or francs rather than dollars, the U.S. Treasury would thus bear the full risk of a further decline in the dollar. Foreign central banks are in a position to demand that the U.S. Treasury do this. They have refrained because they want to see a Republican return to the White House in November, believing that the U.S. market is more likely to remain open to their exports under a Republican administration. They fear that if they humiliate the U.S. Treasury by demanding that it borrow in non-dollar currencies, the issue could be used in electioneering in the United States to the benefit of the Democrats, who are perceived as protectionists. Nevertheless, the Bank of Japan and the Finance Ministry were willing to put pressure on Baker in January of this year to agree to swap the special drawing rights that the United States holds in the International Monetary Fund for any additional yen the Treasury may need for currency support operations. The key paragraph here being foreign central banks are in a position to demand that the U.S. Treasury do this. They have refrained because they want to see a Republican return to the White House in November, believing that the U.S. market is more likely to remain open to their exports under a Republican administration. Well, there is a phrase that I like to use on this program and have used many times in the past. It's a quote from Adlai Stevenson, the late Adlai Stevenson, who noted that in a democracy, people usually get the kind of government they deserve. The economic ruination of America, which is really what Ronald Reagan has wrought. For the time being, we're flying high on borrowed capital, but you never borrow money and just don't pay it back. Ultimately, the notes are going to come due. It's, I think, not at all coincidental and more than a little significant that Ronald Reagan himself has played a role in this country's political assassination, specifically by refusing to extradite Edgar Eugene Bradley to New Orleans in Jim Garrison's investigation, endorsed by the House Select Committee to a considerable extent, that is to say, the Garrison investigation. Ronald Reagan helped frustrate the investigation of the assassination of JFK, and again, the core element of that was explicitly fascist, and thereby helped the swastika to rise over America. Again, on the Rockefeller Commission in 1975, he, as part of the group that was examining the possibility of CIA involvement in the assassination of President Kennedy, ruled predictably that there was none. Now, of course, he's president, and, well, I think we're in a position to see just where we're at this point. Essentially, the political and economic future of America is now firmly and securely in the hands of the Japanese and Germans. Brings to mind an old joke, which I also have used before on this program. It's a good thing the United States didn't lose World War II, otherwise all of our officials would be named Schultz, Weinberger, and Kissinger, and everyone would be driving Japanese and German cars. Something to think about. Something to think about also is my contention that essentially at this point the United States is a Japanese and German colony, and I mean that quite literally. colonies where a nation uses its investment capital in order to exploit its colony's labor and natural resources in order to produce finished goods for its own markets and the markets in its colonies. Consider America's current position and ask yourself whether or not we are now a Japanese and German colony, and I mean that quite literally.
This last section of the prepared portion of tonight's archive show is going into the archives as an addendum to the miscellaneous archive show, Japanese Fascism, Its History and Significance for Contemporary Americans. Now, what we're going to be doing here is taking a look at some of the wartime activities of the Japanese occupation government in China, and specifically, we're going to be taking a look at the activities not only of the military and the wartime occupation government, but also the activities of the zaibatsu. The zaibatsu were the so-called family trusts, the giant family trusts, four huge companies that represented the backbone of Japanese fascism, and which also, not incidentally, had profound connections with American corporate interests as well. Again, the miscellaneous archive show on Japanese fascism goes into that. The four family trusts, the four zaibatsu, by the way, are Mitsubishi, Mitsui, Yasuda, and Sumitomo. And we'll give the spellings later on in the program. We're going to be taking a look now at something which not only reflects backward, but which reflects forward in history. We're going to be taking a look at the role of Japan in actively promoting the opium trade in occupied China, both to finance their various military and industrial activities, and also to suppress the Chinese people and to break their will, something which reflects forward on American activities to a certain extent as well. There are segments of the U.S. intelligence community that have dealt in narcotics in a similar fashion, to fund covert operations, and some have also speculated that it also serves to break the will of people in this country who they would like to keep down, people of color in inner-city neighborhoods, potential political activists, etc. That's never been it's demonstrated absolutely that elements of our intelligence system are deeply complicit in the narcotics trade. The exact motivation for doing that beyond funding of covert operations has never been established, but many people believe that it is also to basically suppress a population, segments of our own population. By way of gaining some historical perspective on those types of activities and taking a look at official government sponsorship of the narcotics traffic, we're going to jump back in time and we're going to take a look at the first onset of fascism, and in this case we're going to be taking a look at Japanese fascism. Research credit on the following goes to a listener, by the way, an individual who has a background working with our intelligence system. This individual sent me these extracts from a book called The Other Nuremberg, subtitled The Untold Story of the Tokyo War Crimes Trials. This was authored by Arnold C. Brackman, B-R-A-C-K-M-A-N. Once again, The Other Nuremberg, The Untold Story of the Tokyo War Crimes Trials, Arnold C. Brackman, B-R-A-C-K-M-A-N. Unfortunately, I do not have the publisher and publication date, just the title and author. In Chapter 16, which this listener has extracted for me, we're going to find some fascinating discussion of how the Japanese actively promoted the opium trade in occupied China during the Second World War in order to finance their various national security activities and also to suppress the Chinese people. And this, by the way, was discussed in the war crimes trials of some of the Japanese leaders. And again, this is in Chapter 16, entitled Unconventional Warfare, Drugs and Disease. Skipping down, part of the prosecution's case on the drug trade had emerged earlier. Japan's narcotics policy in China, like a periscope, revealed itself intermittently and briefly amid the evidence on the rape of Nanking. The first time the subject of drugs arose during the trial was in the testimony of the American surgeon Robert O. Wilson, W-I-L-S-O-N, who casually observed that it had been a capital offense to sell drugs in Nanking and elsewhere in nationalist China until the arrival of the Japanese. But within a year of the Japanese occupation, public opium dens had sprouted like reeds along the banks of the Yangtze. Another witness recalled that with the coming of the Japanese, quote, heroin was very easy to get, unquote, in Nanking, and the Chinese laborers, so-called coolies, whose ages ranged from 10 to 30 years, were often paid off in heroin cigarettes. The most telling evidence on the drug situation, however, was offered by Minor Cyril Bates, that's capital M-I-N-E-R, capital S-E-A-R-L-E, Bates, capital B-A-T-E-S, who independently had made several studies of the opium trade in occupied China. Within a year of Nanking's capture, he testified, the sale of opium in the former capital had become rampant, and the Japanese Army's Special Services Branch did a brisk $3 million monthly business in opium, heroin, and morphine. By the way, the Rape of Nanking refers to a brutal massacre of hundreds of thousands of Chinese that took place over a period of a few days in the city of Nanking. That's the reference to the Rape of Nanking. Once again, within a year of Nanking's capture, he testified, the sale of opium in the former capital had become rampant, and the Japanese Army's Special Services Branch did a brisk $3 million monthly business in opium, heroin, and morphine. Bates conservatively estimated that 50,000 people, or one-eighth of the city's population, had been heavy users of drugs early in the Japanese occupation. As a corollary, he observed that there was a strong relationship between narcotics and crime. He noted that robberies by addicts in Nanking had reached epidemic proportions, quote, a serious matter for everyone, unquote. But the highlight of his testimony was in connection with his visit to Tokyo in 1939. At the Foreign Ministry, he had conferred with a Japanese expert in opium trafficking who had recently returned from a two-month inspection tour of central China. Quote, he told me that he was greatly distressed at the terrible addiction that he saw in Hankou and other cities of the Yangtze Valley, unquote, Bates testified. Again quoting, when I asked him if there was any hope for improvement, he shook his head sadly and said, no, the general told me that so long as the war continues, there is no hope of anything better because no other good source of revenue has been found for the puppet government. Last sentence again. When I asked him if there was any hope for improvement, he shook his head sadly and said, quote, no, the general told me, the general told me that so long as the war continues, there is no hope of anything better because no other good source of revenue has been found for the puppet government, unquote. According to one of Bates's studies, by 1940 there were 600 licensed opium emporiums in Peking, 460 in Hankou, that's H-A-N-K-O-W, and 852 in Canton. Quote, the situation through the occupied areas was one of the open sale of opium in government shops or licensed shops and the aggressive peddling of heroin, he said. Again quoting, in some cases, there was attractive advertising of opium. In some cases, Japanese soldiers used opium as payment for prostitutes and for labor engaged on the military supply dumps, unquote. China's associate prosecutor, Shang Chae-chun, that's capital S-A, capital H-S-I-A-N-G, capital C-H-E hyphen, small C-H-U-N, handled the main phase of the IPS case on narcotics. Wherever the Japanese trod in China, he charged, they had created opium monopolies under the guise of suppressing the use of opium. The monopoly served as a conduit for the distribution and sale of opium and its derivatives, heroin and morphine, to Chinese men, women, and children. The Japanese, however, dealt harshly with Japanese soldiers or Japanese nationals in China using drugs. Japan's opium operations, Shang said, had a double objective: to weaken the Chinese people's will to resist and to provide substantial revenues, quote, to finance Japanese military and economic aggression, unquote. Once again, that last sentence. Japan's opium operations, Shang said, and again, he's the Chinese prosecutor in this war, Japanese war crimes trial, or war crimes trial of Japanese. Once again, Japan's opium operations, Shang said, had a double objective: to weaken the Chinese people's will to resist and to provide substantial revenues, quote, to finance Japanese military and economic aggression, unquote. Japan's trafficking in narcotics, moreover, was in contravention of international treaties to halt the spread of drugs that the Japanese themselves had solemnly signed. Among these were the Hague Convention for the Suppression of the Abuse of Opium and Other Drugs, the Covenant of the League of Nations with respect to the traffic in opium and other drugs, and the Geneva Convention relating to narcotics drugs. The Allies' evidence was overwhelming. As early as June 4, 1932, the chief of staff of the Kwantung Army in occupied Manchuria, with Tokyo's approval, set up an opium monopoly to finance the creation of the state of Manchukuo. By the way, Kwantung is capital K-W-A-N-T-U-N-G. Last sentence again. As early as June 4, 1932, the chief of staff of the Kwantung Army in occupied Manchuria, with Tokyo's approval, set up an opium monopoly to finance the creation of the state of Manchukuo. Joseph Keenan's investigators had discovered a contract in the files of the Industrial Bank of Japan to finance Manchukuo's establishment by the floating of 30 million yen worth of bonds. This next part is just wild. Listen to this. Joseph Keenan, by the way, K-E-E-N-A-N. Joseph Keenan's investigators had discovered a contract in the files of the Industrial Bank of Japan to finance Manchukuo's establishment by the floating of 30 million yen worth of bonds. Several Zaibatsu banks, that's Z-A-I-B-A-T-S-U, several Zaibatsu banks, including Mitsubishi, M-I-T-S-U-B-I-S-H-I, Yasuda, capital Y-A-S-U-D-A, Kawasaki, capital K-A-W-A-S-A-K-I, Sumitomo, capital S-U-M-I-T-O-M-O, and Mitsui, capital M-I-T-S-U-I, formed a consortium to underwrite the sale of the bonds. Article 4 of the financial arrangement read, quote, "These bonds shall be secured by the profits of the opium monopoly. The principal and interest shall be paid preferentially from the monopoly profits." So what we're seeing here are Zaibatsu banks, Mitsubishi, Yasuda, Kawasaki, Sumitomo, and Mitsui, basically floating 30 million yen worth of bonds to support the setting up of an official government opium monopoly in Manchukuo to finance the Japanese occupation state of Manchukuo. That was Japanese-occupied Manchuria. This is absolutely wild. I mean, unfortunately, it's true. Once again, this last sentence of this financial arrangement, Article 4 of the financial arrangement read, quote, "These bonds shall be secured by the profits of the opium monopoly. The principal and interest shall be paid preferentially from the monopoly profits," unquote. In addition, a financial incentive was provided to the growers of the poppy in Japanese-occupied areas. Farmers engaged in the production of foodstuffs could borrow $1.80 an acre at 7% interest per year for every acre they planted. For those who cultivated the poppy, the source of opium, a loan of $12 per acre at 2.3% interest could be obtained. Even so, according to a report from a U.S. Treasury Department agent stationed in Shanghai, tendered as evidence, the loans were rigged to deceive the Chinese peasants. Quote, "Many farmers who anticipated considerable profit from the cultivation of poppy found that, owing to the compulsory order requiring them to sell their opium exclusively to the Japanese at a fixed price which was much below market value, they were unable to make any profit at all," unquote, the report explained. Again quoting, "After the harvest, many of the farmers could not repay their loans and their lands were confiscated," unquote. Although hundreds of thousands of acres of land were turned over to poppy cultivation in occupied China, more than 150,000 acres in Manchuria, the Japanese authorities were unable to meet the insatiable demand of addicts whose ranks were swelling into the millions. The Japanese resolved the problem by importing opium from abroad, principally Iran. Once again, the Zaibatsu surfaced at the trial. Mitsubishi, according to the evidence at the IMTFE, controlled narcotic shipments and distribution in Manchukuo, while Mitsui handled central and south China. North China, however, was a source of contention. Quote, "The distribution for North China shall be shared equally by two companies," a contract drawn up in 1939 read. Skipping down, Manchukuo was the first Japanese-occupied territory to feel the impact of these policies. A third of the country's 30 million people were turned into addicts within a relatively short period. In the witness box, Tunikazu Namba, that's T-S-U-N-E-K-A-Z-U, capital N-A-M-B-A, the former vice director of the Manchukuo Opium Monopoly Bureau, the director was a Manchurian, claimed that his goal had been to establish a strict prohibition on the use of narcotics and thus reduce the number of addicts. Pressed by New Zealand's associate prosecutor, Ronald Quilliam, Q-U-I-L-L-I-A-M, Namba added, however, that during Manchukuo's 10-year opium suppression program, the Monopoly Bureau's profits had risen. But Namba did not attribute this to the increase in the number of addicts as much as to the amount sold and higher prices. So, again, the Zaibatsu actually helping to underwrite the financing of the Japanese occupation government in Manchukuo by floating 30 million yen worth of bonds. And again, the names are names very familiar to the knowledgeable American today. Mitsubishi, Yasuda, Kawasaki, Sumitomo, and Mitsui. So the pattern of financing national security affairs through the opium traffic is by no means original with the United States or limited to us. And again, this is a remarkable piece of history here, and we're indebted to this listener for sharing this with us. And this will go into the archives as an addendum to the Miscellaneous Archive Show, Japanese Fascism its history and significance for contemporary Americans. Again, the Japanese banks, the Zaibatsu banks, floating 30 million yen worth of bonds to promote the opium monopoly in Manchukuo to not only finance Japanese activities, but also to help suppress the Chinese people.
That concludes the prepared portion of this broadcast. Now, all of our archive broadcast shows are on permanent file with the Tape Duplication Company.